Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And this is Mariah Ibarra. She called us from Palm Springs, California.
I am a caregiver for my sister, who has mental illness and many disabilities. And she spends out her insurance and Social Security by August every year. And so I end up having to drive to Mexico to pick up drugs that will fill in for her for about 3 or 4 months.
And she has to take that trip to Mexico every year. Americans choosing to cross the border to buy affordable life-saving medications has become an all-too-common story. It is an inexcusable travesty in the richest nation in the world. But the problem of bank-breaking prescription drugs in the U.S. is so bad, it's become downright surreal. Because get this, not only are some Americans traveling to other countries on their own to buy their meds, in some states, insurance companies are paying for them to do it. Ann Lovell has rheumatoid arthritis. In 2004, she started taking a medication called Enbrel.
It's critical. If I wasn't on that medicine, I would have had to have gone on disability years ago.
Lovell is hearing impaired and worked as a teacher for deaf students until she retired in July 2020. She lived in Salt Lake City, Utah. Her health insurance, Public Employees Health Program, or PEHP, which she'll be on until she qualifies for Medicare, covers more than 150,000 Utah public employees and their family members. Now, when Lovell first started taking Enbrel, it cost her $50 a month. Then, $450. And then, in 2018, PEHP told her she'd have to pay $2,400 a month to get her medication. That's when she saw a tweet from that same insurer, PEHP. It was something about pharmaceutical tourism.
Huh? What's that about? So then I clicked on the link. And it said, if you were on these drugs, you could qualify. And there was my drug, Enbrel.
Utah's Public Employees Health Program was making Lovell an offer that, quite frankly, she couldn't refuse. The insurer offered to pay for Lovell and a companion to fly to Tijuana to pick up her prescription. They'd also give her $500 for her time. And in exchange, PEHP would only have to pay half the cost of Enbrel versus if Lovell got it in the United States. So let's be clear. You are actually hearing this correctly. An insurer paid for people to go to Mexico to get cheaper medication. Now, the $500 cash incentive sprung from a 2018 Utah state law called Right to Buy, which said that if an insurance company is saving money, then patients need to be reimbursed for those savings. State Rep. Norman Thurston sponsored the bill, and he says patients have embraced the program.
The interesting thing for me is that some of those people they'll blow through their deductible in the first couple of months of the year. So they're maybe not saving all that much money, but they understand that this is just kind of sticking it to the man, if you will, right? Like they're going to go even when they're not personally saving all that much money, because it's the right thing to do for the system, right? Is to kind of develop that behavior. And the more people to do it, the better it gets.
Ann Lovell went to Mexico on the program in 2019. She left her house around 5 a.m. and went to the airport in Salt Lake. She was excited. Her friend was coming with her. She thought, hey, maybe it could be a fun day.
Part of me was thinking, go to Mexico. I mean, it didn't turn out to be that cool. You drive across the border, go straight to the doctor's office, and then you go back to the airport. It was really hard on me to take a long one-day trip. The first trip, I got home about midnight. And so that was hard. And I have a lot of health issues. and it was really hard physically.
In 2019 and 2020, Anne Lovell went to Mexico to get her medications on this program a total of 5 times. Then, March 2020, of course, COVID hit and the nation was locked down. PEHP, her insurer, had to offer patients a new option for getting their medications at a lower cost. And Lovell says that's when they told her about the drug manufacturer's copay program, where she'd only have to pay $5 a month.
It drives me absolutely bananas. You know, I could have been doing this all along. However, the insurance company wouldn't have saved money. I would have saved money. But the insurance wouldn't save money like they did going to Mexico. So it's like, it's crazy. Why didn't they just get me on it? But no, they wanted to save the money. And I was willing to take the trip. And I didn't know there were other options.
So that's where we are as a nation. Like Anne says, it's crazy. I mean, in my view, prescription drug pricing in this country is more surreal than even the most nightmarish Hieronymus Bosch painting. How's that for a public radio reference? But I just can't help it, because yesterday when I asked you to call us and tell us your prescription drug stories, we got a lot of calls, and almost every single call shared a similar thought. Quote, it's crazy. Quote, what's going on? Quote, we're guinea pigs. Quote, healthcare sucks. But could the nightmare end? That's the question, right? It's always the question. Well, right now in the House, Democrats are trying to resuscitate an old idea. Let Medicare use its massive purchasing power to negotiate lower drug prices. But that idea has already met a very powerful roadblock from Democrats. Okay, so let's figure this out. Jack Beatty is with us. He's On Point's news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Magda.
And Jonathan Cohn is with us as well, senior national correspondent at HuffPost, author of The 10-Year War, Obamacare, and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, Magna.
Okay, so what's going on in the House regarding this renewed effort to get a hold of prescription drug pricing?
So, 2 years ago, House Democrats got together, and as you say, we've been talking about this for a long time, and Democrats have been talking about this for a long time. Even some Republicans have been talking about this for a long time. Prescription drug prices are too high. We need to do something. And the big idea out there is to have the government negotiate prices with manufacturers, which, by the way, is what happens in every other developed nation, and it's why they spend so much less on their prescription drugs. 2 years ago, House Democrats actually got together and they had a very contentious debate among themselves, and they were able to put together a bill, and they actually passed it. Speaker Pelosi saw it through the process, and they put together this bill that would have introduced government negotiation of prices, and would have taken a bunch of other steps, would have brought down prices for consumers and saved the government a bunch of money. Now, at the time, the Republicans controlled the Senate. Mitch McConnell refused to take it up. And Donald Trump was president and didn't really push to have it taken up. Well, fast forward 2 years. Now Democrats have control of the Senate. They have a Democrat in the White House. And so there's another effort to make this happen. And they are close. But the Democratic majority in the House is much smaller than it was. In the Senate is exactly 50 votes, which is the minimum you need to pass a bill. And so they need almost complete unanimity in the House. They need to get the entire Senate. And there are a few holdouts who say, no, we don't like this bill in the House. And so right now the House is trying to negotiate. What is it going to take to get those holdouts on board?
Okay, so we're going to talk about that more in a second. And Jack, I promise I will come to you in a moment. But Jonathan, just let me take a step back here, because look, I am a decently informed person, I would say. And when I heard of Anne Lovell's story and the sort of workaround that the state of Utah had come up with, I'll admit I had to scrape my jaw up off the floor. I mean, it is crazy. And you've said before, Americans have a kind of fatalism when it comes to this problem of prescription drug prices. I mean, why shouldn't they? If we're at the point where state insurers are paying people, they're paying people to travel to Mexico. That is just nuts, isn't it?
It is nuts. Again, no other economically advanced country does it this way. You know, no, the prices here are higher. We make people go through ridiculous hoops to get drugs at affordable prices. And of course, what ends up happening is a lot of people don't get their drugs and, you know, they end up sicker because of it. So it is a crazy system. It is unique to the U.S. And the question is now whether we can do something about it.
Okay, Jack, do you think we're at the point of being able to do something about it?
Well, it's going to require a miracle drug, you might say. The prospects look very dubious now, and so much rides on it. It isn't just that this would, quote, save money overall. It would pay for, that is, the money, the $700 billion over a decade that Medicare negotiating with the drug companies could save. That it isn't only that it would save that money, it's what the money would be used for. And crucially, it would be used for expanding Medicaid coverage to African Americans in the South who are locked out of it now because their states won't expand Medicaid under Obamacare. This plan would save money to allow them to find a way to insure themselves through private companies. So it's a matter of life and death for those folks.
Well, in the next segment, we're going to be hearing from a couple of members of Congress here. And Jack, we've got about a minute before the break, so I want to let you start on your analysis of what I said a little bit earlier. I mean, Jonathan points out that Congress was within a couple of votes of maybe getting this through, but that block is coming from other Democrats.
Yeah, three in particular, Kurt Schrader of Oregon, Scott Peters, San Diego, Kathleen Rice, Nassau County, Long Island, New York. Their rationales differ, their situations differ. But of all of them, Scott Peters seems the most dubious. He says it's because he's got 27,000 drug employees in his district. Sam Rayburn, former Speaker of the House, used to have a test when people would come to him and say, I can't make this tough vote. He'd say, well, how did you do in your last election? And looking at Scott Peters, he'd say, well, you won it by 21 points and Joe Biden won the district by more than that. And you're telling me this is a tough vote for you? I'm telling you, Sam Rayburn would say to such a person, the top of his head, bald head growing redder and redder, I'm telling you, you're bought.
Well, we're actually going to hear from Congressman Scott Peters when we come back from the break. So Jack Beatty and Jonathan Cohn, stand by. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and here's another small story of the travels through the strange lands of prescription drug pricing that Americans have to take. This is John from Seattle, Washington, who told us he was out of the country once when he found the same medication that he has a prescription for in the U.S. So he bought that medication internationally and then came home and tried to bring it through customs.
So I showed them, here's my pill bottle with my name on it and my medication, and here's what I bought, same thing. And they said, no, that's illegal, you're smuggling contraband. And not only did they confiscate it, but now I'm on a federal watch list anytime I travel internationally, when I come back into the country, I am flagged to be checked to see if I'm bringing contraband.
So this hour, we're talking about whether or not the country, specifically Congress, is on the brink, could be on the brink of fixing this craziness. I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. And Jonathan Cohn is with us as well, senior national correspondent at HuffPost. And Jack and Jonathan, I'm going to ask you if you could to sort of sit in the wings for a few minutes and listen along with me as we talk to two members of Congress about the current effort to reform prescription drug pricing. And then I'm going to come back to the two of you to sort of help us understand what we have just heard. So the first is Congressman Scott Peters. Jack, you mentioned him just before the break. He represents California's 52nd district. That's in and around the San Diego area. And Peters is one of the three Democrats on the powerful House Energy and Commerce Committee who blocked the prescription drug pricing legislation just last week before it could come to the House floor for a vote. So why did he vote no?
I voted no on that plan. There's no disagreement among Democrats that we have to lower the cost of prescription drugs for seniors. And I fully support that. The problem with the current proposal, which we call HR3, is that it's really not a negotiation about prices. It sets a price based on an international reference and then assesses a 95% tax against a company that would not pay that price. What that does is, while it does lower drug costs, it also really threatens the future of investment in these innovations. So if you think about the development of drugs and discovery, it's a partnership of the public sector and the private sector. Democrats have worked really hard to increase the budget for the National Institutes of Health from $29 billion when I first came to Congress in 2013 to $43 billion now. But in the private sector, the private sector invests about $100 billion in turning that science into products. And it's a high-risk business. It costs $1 billion to bring a drug to market, and at no risk to taxpayers, but mostly they fail. And we only pay for them when they're deemed to be safe and effective at the back end. What we don't want to do is disincentivize that investment by changing the risk profile, by changing the return without changing the risk profile. And that's what I'm afraid that HR3 would do. The CBO admits that the Congressional Budget Office admits that we would lose cures. Other agencies and analysts say at a much higher rate than CBO predicts. And the investors themselves have told us that if they're faced with this 95% profits tax at the back end, that they won't invest at the front end.
Yeah, so this argument about the high cost of innovation, which is getting higher with every year as the drugs become more sophisticated, right? I mean, we're entering the era of even sort of personalized medicine as well. We've heard that from the pharmaceutical industry for a long time here. But I think Americans feel like they're kind of at the breaking point here. They're wondering how much longer, not just seniors, but almost at any age, will they have to essentially shoulder the price for pharmaceutical development? So we've heard from so many people in just the past 24 hours, Congressman. I mean, this is a caller, James from Spokane, Washington. He spends his drugs cost $39,000 a month to keep him alive. And here's what he said.
Our senators are selling out for their job, and they don't care about those of us who are here and rely on the medication.
Obviously, James referring to senators there, and you're in the House, Representative Peters. But how would you respond to that?
I don't disagree with James. I proposed an alternative. I didn't just vote no, which is unfortunately what some people have the impression I did. We proposed a bill that would, for the first time, limit out-of-pocket drug expenses for any senior to a maximum of $3,100 a year, and for lower-income seniors, $1,200. That's a lower cap than the HR3 cap. It caps insulin expenses at $50 a month. It allows Medicare to negotiate for better prices when there's market failures, when there's no generics, no competition. And it pays for that by imposing a cap on price increases that biopharmaceutical companies can charge. It claws back profits from all the way back from 2016, 5 years ago. And it stops the patent games that companies sometimes use to extend out the exclusivity that they get from patents. So I'm fully on board with James. What I think we need to do is exactly what he said. Let's lower the cost of prescription drugs for seniors, as we promised, as all Democrats agree. Let's not do it by putting American science at risk. And that's what my proposal accomplishes. My proposal accomplishes both goals.
Well, here's what another listener, this is Mel from New Mexico, what he sees in the no vote that we've been talking about.
That ship sunk because Big Pharma paid off again for representatives from the House to make sure that that doesn't pass.
Now, Congressman, I'm seeing here that you're one of the largest recipients of campaign dollars from the pharmaceutical industry. In 2019 and 2020, your campaign got almost $230,000 from them. Did that influence your vote in any way?
You know, I would like to say that I represent the third largest life science hub in the country. And I've stood up for this center of science for more than 20 years, going back to when I was on city council. I've been named the biotechnology legislator of the year for a long time, even before I was in Congress. There's nearly 1,000 firms in my region, not just big pharmaceutical companies like Eli Lilly or Bristol-Myers Squibb or Johnson & Johnson, but small firms trying to solve these problems. Research institutions, universities, small biotech companies. So it's no surprise that the people who work at those places would support my campaigns. And I guess if I was from Michigan, I might expect support from the employees of GM or Ford. I think that's an easy line of attack. I think it avoids the question of how do we lower the cost of prescription drugs for seniors while we preserve this amazing innovation ecosystem that's a partnership of both the public and the private sector.
Well,
I think we have to do both.
Yeah. And so I want to get back to your idea here in just a second. But let me follow up on the criticism regarding campaign finance. I also note that you won re-election by a very comfortable margin in 2020, right? More than 20 points, 23 points. So I think, you know, the Democratic Party would look at your seat, you know, at least for the time being, as a safe seat. So when it comes to advancing what could be a monumental positive change for Americans regarding giving them affordable prescription drugs, maybe you might lose some jobs in your district, but isn't that worth it? You still probably win, but isn't that worth advancing affordable drugs for the rest of the country?
The premise of your question is that I'm worried about my election more than my district, and I'm not. I think what we're talking about is a bill that risks American science. We're talking in our committee about trying to onshore the basic pharmaceutical manufacturing that's left to China. What I don't want to see happen is that this high-end innovation would go to China or India or Israel or someplace else. This is what this is about. It's not about me getting reelected. It's about me standing up for American science. And, you know, I'm going to do that every day of the week, as I've been doing for 20 years since I first got into politics. Mm.
And I heard you a little earlier saying that the other plan that you've advanced would limit out-of-pocket payments for people, for seniors in particular? Okay.
Our proposal is as good for seniors, I'd argue better, because we take care of low-income seniors at a lower level than HR3. You know, $3,100 a year cap, but for low-income folks, $1,200, $50 cap on insulin, negotiate prices with allow Medicare to negotiate prices. All the things that Democrats have promised seniors, my bill would accomplish. What it wouldn't do is disincentivize the creation of new cures and put American science at risk. I will not do that.
Last question, since I have you. How are you going to vote on reconciliation?
Well, I'd like to see the final bill. I mean, this is a $3.5 trillion concept without a lot of details. And I hope that we can, after this, I'm going to work to come up with some fixes on the drug pricing part of it. But certainly, like I said, I've made my position on HR3 pretty clear. I've offered an alternative that accomplishes our goals. And I'm going to work to make sure that gets incorporated.
That's Representative Scott Peters. He represents California's 52nd district. He's a Democrat on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And as we mentioned last week, he voted no on the committee on this idea to let Medicare negotiate prescription drug prices. So let's turn now to Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. She's representative from Illinois' 9th congressional district, has been a congressperson for that district since 1999. Representative Schakowsky, welcome.
Thank you so much, Meghna. I appreciate it.
So if we, the American people, allowed Medicare to vigorously negotiate prescription drug prices, would that as Representative Peters say, put American science at risk?
Oh, absolutely not. And that's why 90% of Americans, Representative Peters is wrong. It is not just lowering the drug prices for seniors. For all Americans, this kind of negotiation would stop Americans from paying 2 to 3 times more for the same drugs as people around the world pay. You know, we're somehow the chumps here, having to pay so much more. And what we know is that the leading drug companies have spent $56 billion more on stock buybacks, on dividends for investors, for CEO pay, than they actually invested in research and development last year. And so we aren't risking innovation. We aren't risking new drugs. And by the way, American taxpayers spend a lot, billions and billions of dollars. In fact, the top 356 newest drugs that were produced were all paid in part by research and development by taxpayers. Mm.
Representative Schakowsky, I mean, as you well know, the three Democrats on energy and commerce who stopped the advancing of this idea, at least for now, I mean, of them, Congressman Rice says that, quote, I do not support advancing policies that are not fiscally responsible and jeopardize the bill's final passage. What do you think about that?
Well, I really don't understand her argument, because that legislation, our legislation to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, would not only help consumers, but it means that the federal government would pay $62 billion less for those drugs, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, through negotiation. And you know that that we do see negotiation happening at the Veterans Administration. And as a consequence, veterans actually see lower drug prices. It really does work. 90%, as I said, of Americans, that means Democrats, Republicans, independents, everybody believes that we have to have lower drug prices. And we know that 18 million people right now have said that recently they could not afford their drugs. They couldn't pay for it. I've been behind people in the drugstore who have actually had to walk away rather than pay for their prescription. There are people literally dying right now because they can't pay for the drugs that they need to live.
Now, Representative Schakowsky, you heard Representative Peters a few minutes ago describe his alternative plan, right? Which would, as he says, allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices when there are, quote unquote, market failures. So that's kind of a limited condition, I guess, when there's a company no longer has exclusive marketing rights on an older drug, but there are no competitors. I mean, he talked about when there are no generics available. He says that his plan would put a cap, an annual cap on price increases, and stop what he called patent games. So what's the big difference you see between the plan that he says he supports versus what most House Democrats are trying to push forward?
Well, first of all, once again, he talked about lowering drug prices for seniors. Mm-hmm. And of course, our bill would lower drug prices for all consumers in the United States. And what we want to do is to take some of the most popular drugs that even the president of the United States has said that those drug prices are outrageously expensive, and lower them. This is an initiative that the president of the United States, as well as most of the vast majority of Democrats, support. His plan would only segment the lowering of drug prices and not do it across the board for all consumers and to take a look at the ridiculously high priced drugs. And not just a few of those drugs.
Well, I will note that the plan that Representative Peters talked to us about, I don't believe that there has been any actual scoring on that plan yet regarding the budget efficiencies or inefficiencies. But there was a similar bill in the Senate that was scored as producing only 20% of the savings versus the, you know, sort of the bigger plan that you and other Democrats are advocating here. So
absolutely. We can't just take this huge cut in a benefit to consumers and a benefit to the taxpayers by lowering the cost of prescription drugs.
Yeah.
And the fact that we pay 2 to 3 times more than any other countries is just an outrage. And everyone, you know, the president said it's hard to find any other issue that has such agreement across the board.
Well,
of all
Representative,
Americans.
On that point, I have 30 seconds left with you, and I've got to ask you, how broken is Congress? And here we're talking about the Democrats. How broken is Congress that it might be possible we're going to reach a conversation about reconciliation without any prescription drug modifications there?
No, that is impossible. And I think that already we have seen that other committees have made it possible for us to move forward with this comprehensive lowering of drug prices, not just a few, not just a smaller percent, but for the major drug prices. This is what consumers want. People are dying as we speak right now because they can't have it. So having, you know, all these drugs and the pharmaceutical companies making huge profits has left so many people out in the cold.
Well, Representative Schakowsky, thank you for your time. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are taking a look at whether Congress is potentially at a point of making major changes when it comes to the cost of prescription drugs in this country. And I really want to keep bringing in the voices of you Americans here, because we've heard from so many of you. Here's Dallas from Oklahoma, who has epilepsy, and Dallas has to take 2 medications a month that cost $2,000 each, so $4,000 a month. Now, Dallas does have Medicare, which he says pays for almost all of that, 99% of the price. But there's a catch. Dallas says in terms of his job, there's only so much he is allowed to earn. And he can't earn any more. He can't take any more hours at work if he wants to keep this insurance coverage.
I'm not able to accept raises because the more I get paid, the less hours I am able to work. I've actually lost jobs because of the few hours I was able to work.
And here's James from Spokane, Washington, who was diagnosed with late onset adult cystic fibrosis.
For the next 8 or 10 years, I was using $39,000 worth of medication a month. They came out with a new medication. Oh, and it's only $21,000 a month. The thing that gets me is nobody talks about the Congress and the lobbyists that pay so much money to have these laws made where they're untouchable.
Well, Jonathan Cohn is with us. He's been listening along. He's senior national correspondent at HuffPost and author of The 10-Year War, Obamacare and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. And Jack Beattie is with us as well, On Point's news analyst extraordinaire. And Jack, let me just start with you here. You listened as Representative Scott Peters and Jan Schakowsky joined us in the previous segment. What stood out most to you, Jack?
Well, Representative Peters stressed the importance, the centrality of innovation. And basically he said any effort to really throttle drug prices will cost innovation and therefore life-saving drugs for Americans. Well, his colleague, Katie Porter, she's a representative from California, in May, she opened the books of a drug company. She was questioning a CEO, and she found in this company they spent $2 billion on research, all right, $5 billion on advertising, and $50 billion in stock buybacks. And then she said to this fellow, the big pharma fairy tale, she said, is one of groundbreaking R&D that justifies high prices. But the pharma reality is that you folks spend most of your company's money making money for yourselves and your shareholders. That was her conclusion looking at the books of this one company.
So, Jonathan Cohn, we have to get to the bottom of this. Jack, I'm so glad that you decided to focus on that for a moment here, because that is the argument that we hear again and again and again. We've been hearing it for decades from the pharmaceutical industry, that if you negotiate down drug prices in the U.S., just like they do almost everywhere else, innovation will suffer. Jack is presenting some pretty compelling evidence that it won't. What's your take?
He is. I mean, look, I think this is a legitimate question, a serious issue. You can imagine a point. I mean, intuitively, if there are less profits for the industry, they're going to attract less investment. And you can imagine a scenario where the reductions were so deep that there really was an effect on innovation. But there are some very powerful arguments for why, number one, that argument is exaggerated. And number two, and particularly when we're talking about this proposal, it's not something to worry about. Jack mentioned some of them, which is about where the pharmaceutical industry actually spends its money. I think it's also worth looking at what counts as innovation today. And this is something that has been studied extensively. So many of the new drugs we see, they don't really add clinical value. They are new versions of old drugs that don't really add something. And yet they are, we're seeing these incredibly high prices for them. The sort of poster child for this is a brand new drug to treat Alzheimer's the list price at introduction was $56,000 a treatment. And there was, frankly, very little evidence, if any, that it made any difference to Alzheimer's patients. A lot of people were surprised it even got approval. And so much of the innovation we see is like that. And at the same time, so much of the sort of groundbreaking research into that leads, it gives us the real breakthroughs, the kind of thing that Scott Peters was talking about. Well, so much of that is from publicly backed research through the National Institutes of Health. And so, there's a very good argument that if you come up with a system where you basically say, look, we're not going to pay a lot for drugs that don't really add value, and simultaneously, we pump a lot more money into NIH, we pump money into public research, which is what the Democrats' bill does, that you would actually be better off.
Yeah, so let me just add some detail here, because you're both are exactly right. Like, the NIH funding, i.e. taxpayer funding, comes into the process early, right? So it's like almost in the riskiest stage, that fundamental research that's advancing our knowledge of or development of new drugs. And then broadly speaking, the private investment comes later, the development, the getting the regulatory approval process, et cetera. But then that also gives those private companies the control over the patents. And as you said, Jonathan, there are frequently kind of patents that are provided or extended for things that don't actually change the drugs themselves. One of my favorite examples is just like a change in the delivery mechanism. And then they get another 10-year exclusive patent. But Scott Peters said he wants to, quote, stop those patent games. Is that something that that A is plausible, and B, is that not in the bigger plans from that the Democrats that he put a stop to in energy and commerce?
So it is plausible. And actually, you know, ending the patent games is actually one of the areas where there's pretty broad agreement. So, you know, it is possible, you know, you could have a bill that just went after the patent games. And that would help, right? I mean, that would make a difference. The question is, would it do enough? I mean, that is sort of one part of a much bigger story. And what, you know, he likes to focus on that because that's something he says he supports. And then he goes on to say, and I also support government negotiation because that's a popular idea. And it's what we really know is the most important tool we have to lower. But as Representative Schakowsky was pointing out, the Scott Peters idea of government negotiation is very limited to a narrow set of drugs. And it's not nearly as powerful a tool as what is in the main House bill. And so really, you're just offering much less help. And the stories you've been hearing about these people who are facing these high costs, a lot of them are not going to see help because of the nature of what Scott Peters wouldn't do.
Now, Jack, let me turn back to you because, I mean, you mentioned Sam Rayburn earlier in the show. You heard Scott Peters summarily reject the assertion that even though he's, what, the top Democrat receiving pharmaceutical campaign funding, he just rejects that he's putting the interests of those businesses above that of the American people as a whole. How did you respond to that when you heard him say that?
Well, again, casting myself in the role of Mr. Sam, the longtime Speaker of the House in the 40s and the 50s, when members would say, I can't vote for this bill because, you know, it could put me in trouble in my district. Or in other words, when they come up with some reason to that isn't true, or that doesn't strike Rayburn as true, to say why they can't vote for a bill, he, at the top of his head, he would get so angry that he would let out a stream of shattering profanity, and the top of his bald head would just pulse red. And I think it would have pulsed red to listen to Mr. Peters because the guy was elected, reelected by 20 odd points. Biden carried the district going away, as you suggested, Meghna. Even if it loses a few jobs in his district, that's one of his rationales. I got 27,000 people in this industry. Even if a few of those jobs are lost, he's a safe bet for re-election. Yet he says he's not going to do it. He can't go along with this bill.
Yeah. So, sorry, Jack. I did not mean to interrupt you. Go ahead and finish.
No, that's all right. I'm just putting a red line under that.
Well, so look, Jonathan, you wrote an entire book about the fight over Obamacare, and there's a number here from 2020, so just last year, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, the pharmaceutical and health products industries spent $309 million on lobbying in 2020, number one in lobbying expenditures amongst industry groups, twice as much as the number two group. Same year, they spent almost $90 million on campaign contributions. So, I mean, are there lessons from, let's say, the fight over Obamacare about how successful the pharmaceutical industry is in its lobbying when it's trying to shape or stop legislation?
Yeah, I don't think it's an exaggeration to call the pharmaceutical lobby the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. And the story of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was one of the ways they got that bill through was they basically went easy on pharma and they basically bought peace with that because they knew they couldn't beat pharma. Now, it's been 10 years. Politics are different. I think the outrage over drug prices has grown. I think the political incentives for Democrats are a little different this time in that I really feel like they feel like they need to deliver. And the drug pricing reforms, if you pull like all the list of things that Democrats are trying to do right now, it is literally the top most popular item. It's popular with Democratic voters. It's popular with independent voters. It's popular with Republican voters. So there is a very strong incentive to make this happen. And if I wanted to give you the sort of optimistic take, if you want this to pass and you're thinking about Representative Peters, I do think it's notable that he is out there saying, I want to do drug price negotiation, and I want to do these other things. He's not taking negotiation off the table. So you got to think there's some middle ground between what he's talking about and, you know, what Nancy Pelosi and what other House Democrats want, that they could find some agreement, maybe.
Mm. Now, before we run headlong into the end of the hour here, Jonathan, there's sort of actually a context question I want to ask you, because there's probably a lot of listeners here who remember what happened, in 2006, right? When we had the development of Medicare Part D, which covers retail prescription drugs. And back then in 06, the law actually made it illegal for the government to negotiate drug prices, right? I mean, there's that portion called the non-interference portion of the law that stipulates that the HHS secretary, quote, may not interfere with the negotiations between drug manufacturers and pharmacies and prescription drug plan sponsors, and may not require a particular formulary to institute a price structure for the reimbursement of covered Part D drugs. Is that what the Democrats are trying to essentially get rid of?
Yes, very much so. That was the result of a big debate that happened back then over, back then Democrats had sort of led the charge. This is we've been talking about this for a long time. So this is 20 years ago. Democrats had led the charge to bring down prescription drug prices. And at that point, Medicare had no drug benefit. So it was very hard for a lot of seniors to just pay for their drugs. So there was Republicans said, yes, we agree there should be a drug benefit. And the argument was, well, what are we going to do about the cost of drugs? And Republicans, with some Democratic support, as then as now, you had some more conservative Democrats who were close to the drug industry, who didn't want to have government interference with the drug industry. And they inserted this clause, and it said, you, the federal government, cannot negotiate prices with the drug industry. So what the bills in Congress now that Democrats are trying to pass that President Biden supports, one of the things they would do is they would strip that out effectively and say, yep, now the government can negotiate. And then we get into the question of, okay, well, what does that mean? What does that negotiation look like? How does it happen?
Okay. Jack Beatty, what does it say to you? Well, actually, let me back up here. There was a little hint of maybe optimism that I heard from Jonathan during the course of this program. And you heard Representative Schakowsky actually end by saying some kind of proposal to let Medicare negotiate drug prices is going to end up in reconciliation. She asserted that. I mean, do you sense that is a warranted optimism, given the fact that we already know that there's a handful of critical Democrats who are opposed to it?
Well, we've been talking about the House.
Yeah.
But when you look at the Senate, there's problems there, too. Bob Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, is is a big fan. Big Pharma is big in New Jersey. Senator Carper, from Delaware. Big Pharma is big there, too. And they're already saying, oh, no, we don't want to go along. You're not going to save $700 billion. You're not going to take that out of the advertising and stock buyback surplus of the drug companies over the next decade. No, it's not going to be that much. Well, for every dollar these senators allow the drug companies to keep under these rules, that means somebody out there is going to be paying more. And one study of inflation in drug prices over a recent, 6 year period found that we're a basket of household goods. The prices went up 11%. For drugs, the prices went up 120%.
Hmm. Jonathan Cohen, I'll let you respond to that, but I'm going to add this. I keep thinking about the double whammy that Americans experience every day when it comes to this, to the issue of prescription drug pricing, because as we've established, they're paying taxes which go to fund the NIH, which is going to fund that research that helps develop these drugs. And then they're also paying high prices, very, very high prices, in part because I've heard pharmaceutical companies say, well, every other country does negotiate down prices. So, you know what? The American people are going to have to shoulder a higher price so that we can actually recoup our costs. So, I mean, I keep thinking of that Hieronymus Bosch paintings. I can't help it. Like, it's just surreal and crazy and bizarre. Is there a way out of this?
So it is bizarre. And, you know, it's ironic, you know, of all people, Donald Trump used to get angry about this, right? And he was the one who said, you know, we pay too much, we need to stand. And so in some ways, fixing this problem is in part, you know, about getting the U.S. to pay what other countries do. So we're not, you know, getting the raw end of the stick. And I do think there's, still a decent chance it can happen.
So we're looking at, what, the next couple of weeks and months to pay extra attention to this, Jonathan?
Weeks and maybe days.
Days. Well, Jonathan Cohn, senior national correspondent at HuffPost, author of The 10-Year War, Obamacare, and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. Thanks as always, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. It's always a pleasure, Jack. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.